House Labor Commerce, and I come to order. It's 3:20 p.m. on April 13th. We have a full committee today. President Representative Ledoux, Representative Tobin, Representative Hughes, Representative Culver, Representative Josephson, Representative Keto, and myself, Chair Olson. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum. Please turn off your cell phones. We have a full calendar today with four bills on the agenda. The first one will be House Bill 169. RCA Rail Belt Electric Utility Report. Presenting the bill will be Conrad Jackson from my office. And I might add, I'd like to acknowledge we have Representative Ledoux in the, Representative Millett in the audience and to present a bill later on. It's my intention to read the bill across and take limited testimony by invitation only. Please proceed, Conrad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson and the Labor and Commerce Committee. The bill before you today, House Bill 169, would direct the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, the RCA, to review and make recommendations regarding a process whereby an independent rail belt transmission operator would be created. I think everyone in the room knows, but for those who do not, when we're speaking of the rail belt, we're speaking of, particularly with energy, we're speaking of the interconnected electrical transmission system, which basically goes from Bradley Lake down around Kachemak Bay all the way up into Fairbanks. The interconnection of these communities by the transmission lines helps keep a large percentage of Alaska safe and secure. With the long distances between utility companies and their generation facilities, the interconnected system is of great importance. The value of improved reliability gained by this interconnection just can't be overstated. The transmission authority proposed to be evaluated by the RCA in this bill would act more as more of a Craigslist type authority, and you've got a gentleman online that can really speak to that. Instead of mandating that utilities pledge their assets to one controlling authority, this concept would allow a more continued local control of assets while at the same time maximizing the value and reliability of that interconnected system. Using this approach, excess power could be posted as available and can be purchased as needed by any utility. This would promote usage of the most economical power along the interconnected system at all times. Without local control of assets, some utilities and their ratepayers stand to be losers in other systems, while others stand to gain from these losses. Consumer pricing and reliability along the rail belt is critical to the success of any transmission company, and is critical for it to work in the long term. Willing participation and continued local control of assets should also be considered critical as Alaska continues to look towards an ISO concept along the rail belt. Last year, the RCA was tasked with the job of reporting to the legislature on an independent system operator concept, and they're nearing completion on their work. The intent of this bill is not to interrupt their work, but to begin discussions on a Craigslist, in air quotes, type of ISO. Following receipt of the report, the legislature may very well want to consider further direction to the RCA, and this bill just takes a first step in that regard. And Mr. Chairman, I believe you have a couple of people online that can speak to this Craigslist type concept and probably be a little more clear as they deal with electrical power generation and transmission on a daily, hourly basis.
And the invited testimony today is T.W. Patch from the RCA and Brad Jaworski from Homer Electric. We have a couple other people that we haven't heard from yet, so I think we'll just take the two that we have. Any questions for Conrad before we go on to the invited testimony? Representative Keto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Conrad, thank you. Thinking maybe I'll have to ask the question again if you don't have the answer and wait for the invited testimony, but I did want to just maybe start off by finding out, you mentioned another report effort going forward, and I guess I'm a little confused about what this report effort is in relation to the report effort you say RCA is currently doing.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, through Representative Keto, House Bill 340, introduced by the representative over my left shoulder last year, was directed the RCA to look at a very similar concept with an independent systems operator. They are very close to being completed. This is just a little bit different twist, a little bit different type of independent system operator, and actually this date is 1 year later than the date proposed in House Bill 340, which is coming up at the end of this fiscal year, I believe.
Okay. A follow-up, I think, that might be more applicable to maybe the RCA, but I'm looking at the fiscal note, and this report effort will have a cost associated with it, although the fiscal note is identified as indeterminate. It's actually identified as indeterminate out through 2021, and I can't imagine the report will be still going on then, so I guess I'm a little confused by the not having any money. So if the fiscal note passes with the bill, there's going to be no money that goes along with it. Where the money's going to come from to be able to do the report, and then when is the report supposed to be due, because the fiscal note seems to imply that there's indeterminate costs out to 2021.
Representative Keto, through the chair, House Bill 340 from last year had a fiscal note that my assumption, and I really should probably stop before I say anything more, but Representative Mr. Patch, as I give a promotion, Mr. Patch from the RCA can speak much better to the fiscal note, but I assume that the asterisks on the fiscal note are there because depending on whether this bill passes or not, some of those funds may be available for this report, but Mr. Patch would be the best person to ask about them.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, this bill will not be moving in the next week, if that helps. This will allow us to have some hearings during the interim. Any further questions for Conrad? First up, from the invited testimony, is Brad Jaworski from Humber Electric. Are you with us, Brad?
Yes, I am, Chairman Olson. You ready for me to speak?
Yep, please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us today.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Brad Jaworski, General Manager of Homer Electric Association. First, I want to state thank you for the opportunity to speak about HB 169. I will keep my comments brief. As I've heard earlier, and I think Mr. Jackson commented, and I know the committee is aware, funded by a legislative appropriation during the last session, the Regulatory Commission is currently directing a study focusing on whether creating an ISO or similar structure for the rail belt transmission system would be the best option for effective and efficient use of the transmission system. Although the Regulatory Commission's efforts are appreciated, it's in my opinion, HB 69 provides additional direction and clarity on the RCA analysis. HB 169 directs the RCA to evaluate the creation of an independent entity to manage the transmission system, and that entity would meet some important criteria that we have identified that bill is important and is in the bill as well. One of those being the entity would be regulated by the RCA. As a result, the entity must obtain a certificate of public convenience and necessity from the RCA and operate under a tariff from the RCA. Secondly, participation in such an entity would be voluntary. This is a critical attribute for HEA. While each utility's participation is important, each should voluntarily enter into the arrangement. I think maybe mentioned earlier, a voluntary model encourages cooperation and reduces the magnitude of winners and losers. As an aside, I talked during lunch hour today with Anchorage Municipal Light and Power's General Manager, Jim Trent, who unfortunately is tied up in a hearing at the RCA, but in my brief discussion with Mr. Trent, he also feels very strongly that any entity created should be voluntary in nature in an effort to try and get everybody to agree to some common set of principles and standards and mitigate any losers, quote, losers in the process. And then lastly, the entity envisioned in HB 169 would allow for continued local control of assets while at the same time maximizing the value and reliability of the interconnected system. In HB HB 169, the entity envisioned would manage and create a voluntary and transparent wholesale energy market without adding significant administrative overhead. This would lead to the most economical distribution of wholesale power on the rail belt. I can note firsthand that HEA in the last several months, and even more recently than that, has worked with other utilities without a middleman, per se, going out and asking, quite frankly, for bids on short-term, spot market energy needs, and quite frankly, we've been pretty successful doing that, and we've been able to do that without creating that administrative middle layer. As most of you are aware, the rail belt is going through some growing periods right now, and our ratepayers and members are having to burden or to shoulder most of those rising costs, and so anything that's going to add to that, we are certainly trying to mitigate. Last December, all the rail belt utilities signed an MOU adopting guiding principles of a rail belt transco. HB 169 appears to be entirely consistent with those principles. The entity envisioned by 169, as most of you have read, would be a transparent, non-discriminatory, and in compliance with established planning and reliability standards. Standards and protocols would be based on established objective transmission, operating, maintenance, planning, and design principles to promote safety, reliability, and economic efficiency across the rail belt grid. Thank you for your opportunity to comment, and I appreciate the work of the committee on this matter.
Well, thank you, Brad. Any questions for Mr. Jaworski? Thanks again, Brad. Next up will be T.W. Patch, Commissioner, RCA Commissioner. Are you with us, Mr. Patch?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am with you.
Oh, you're coming through good. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is T.W. Patch. I'm a commissioner.
T.W., we're going to take a break at ease. I think we're back on the record. Mr. Patch, are you with us?
I am with you, Mr. Chairman. I hope we've solved the echo problem. Thank you very much for your...
we haven't.
That's a long delay.
Well, I will tell you that the RCA did recently get a new state phone system.
T.W., I think I'm going to let you talk, and I'm not going to interrupt you because the echo is coming off of our end. So please continue.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is T.W. Patch. I'm a commissioner with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Chairman...
We've lost you pretty much totally. We're going to take another brief of these. Well, not the same thing. T.W., we're going to go to Fairbanks and then come back here and see if that works.
Very well, sir. I will stand by. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Corey Bergenson, are you with us?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. And we'll see if we get an echo on this. Thank you for joining us today, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Alston, and all members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Corey Borgeson, President and CEO of Golden Valley Electric Association.
Please continue.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, you know, just a little information. For the record, Golden Valley has some 34,000 members and provides electric service as an electric co-op, which is owned by its members in the interior of Alaska. And I wanted to tell you, in general sense, Golden Valley can support House Bill 169. We have a lot of faith and belief in the Regulatory Commission and their sincere efforts. Certainly, T.W. Patch has done a phenomenal job when he was chair, and now Commissioner Pickett has taken up where Mr. Patch left off. I think Golden Valley, and I think most all Rail Belt members and the utilities, generally support changes to how we operate the Rail Belt interties, and understand that how we dispatch the energy needs to be worked on and considered. And I think that this is exactly what House Bill 169 is intending to do. As Mr. Jaworski mentioned in his comments, the makeup of the rail utilities have changed over the last couple of years and are going to continue to evolve as Matanuska Electric Association comes on with their own generation. We've created now five utilities that produce their generation, and there needs to be some additional rules and regulations as we get to be a sort, as I call it, bigger club. Historically, there have been three utilities that primarily produced, not exclusively, but primarily produced all the energy, and kind of the handshake kind of worked. As we've kind of grown and matured here, we think some additional rules are going to be necessary, different organizations, different structures. As part of the Rail Belt group of utilities, we've been talking about this need for change over the last couple of years. It's gotten the attention of the legislature, certainly. Some of that information has come, or the interest to the legislature has come through the independent power producers have found that they believe that they've had some issues with their ability to connect to the inner tie for their own projects, and the utilities, as they become more complex, have found that we need to have an evolution that takes place in the rail belt. So we support the study that is contemplated. As part of a rail belt group, we did sign what we call the guiding principles that we were working with American Transmission Company. All six utilities in the rail belt signed these guiding principles, which I think is an indication of the cooperative spirit that we're having in the rail belt, particularly towards this issue. The guiding principles have been filed with the Regulatory Commission, so they're available for you to look at. The one of the concepts is that it's a voluntary organization, and so you've heard Homer Electric tell you that that's very important to them. We think it's voluntary, but we think what will happen is the markets will prevail. And as we develop this new system, we will have a better economic dispatch of our energy that will save your constituents on their electric costs. So we appreciate this bill coming into play, and it'll be certainly for discussion, and I suspect it'll play in the discussion that'll go on over the summer when the session adjourns and gets ready for everyone as they come back next year. And I thank you for the time here to make these comments.
And we anticipate working on this during the interim, which is one of the reasons that we're holding the meeting today. But thanks again. Any questions for Mr. Borgensen? Seeing none, I think we're going to see if the third time's a charm with T.W. Patch. Commissioner Patch, are you with us?
I am with you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for your patience. I hope this works.
My twin's with us as well. Coming in about 6 seconds behind you, but please continue. It's not coming in as strong, so, and you're coming in good.
I'm glad there is no echo. There is always somewhat of a difficulty in speaking with a extended delay, but I will certainly do my best.
I'm glad there is no echo. There is always somewhat of difficulty.
You know, I don't think this is going to work. Commissioner Patch, I think we're going to have to hold off on you until the
time the committee addresses this issue, but thanks again for joining us, but we're still getting the echo. I think we're getting ours and yours, but thanks again. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will hold this bill over until a later date, most likely during the interim, and take a breath at ease. Now we'll have a real problem. Next item on the calendar is House Bill 66. We heard this bill last week. Took limited public testimony from people that were in the room. We were under two time crunches. We've been pushed back an hour and a half, and we were staring down the barrel of a 5 o'clock meeting that most of us were going to. But we were not able to get to everybody at that point in time, and again, I apologize to anybody that we couldn't get to. Today it's my intention to take up the rest of the testimony, and then the committee is still waiting on the fiscal note and actuary study. So, Grace, can you give us, you know, like a two-minute summary of the bill?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, for the record, Grace Abbott, staff to Representative Millett. Thank you so much again for bringing this bill up and allowing additional opportunity for testimony. I know that we really appreciate it. Just as a quick reminder about House Bill 66, this bill hopes to address the side effect of a situation, obviously, that the state hopes never happens, which is a public employee dying in the line of duty. I know that the short title of this bill can be misleading at times because it refers to just teachers. However, the bill as a whole refers to state employees as a whole. What this would do is provide health care coverage for the families, dependents, and spouses of a state employee who has died in the line of duty by putting them under the PERS-TERS healthcare system, which is is unique in that it is uniform to all public employees, both public employees and teachers. Now, if you'd like me to continue, I'm more than happy to go through the bill in further detail. However, if we want to jump to public testimony.
Actually, I think most of us were here or listening last week, and we do have two other bills. This time of year, we're on a tight schedule, but I'd like to open it up to public testimony if there's no questions for Ms. Abbott. And you can go back to your chair. You can stay there, either one.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman.
I will now open it up, or reopen public testimony, or I guess open it up for the first time. I'm going to start with Brandy Johnson. Are you with us, Brandy?
Yes, I am, Chairman.
Thank you for joining us, and I apologize again for not being able to get through all the testimony last week. Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us again today, and on behalf of the committee, please accept our condolences on your loss, and please continue.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Brandy Johnson, and I'm testifying in support of House Bill 66 on behalf of myself, my three daughters, my late husband, Scott Johnson, and for the spouses of current and past Alaska State Troopers. Prior to this year, I often thought how I'd never experienced the loss of someone close to me. Little did I know when I did, it would be my best friend, husband, and father of my three children, Scott Johnson. Scott's job was that of an Alaska State Trooper. On May 1st, 2014, I had State Troopers waiting for me to get home. Two of Scott's friends and fellow State Troopers later came to the door in tears. They didn't have to tell me. After seeing their faces, I knew Scott was dead. Scott was shot to death by Nathaniel Kangas in Tanana, Alaska, while in the line of duty. 5 years ago, at his 18-year mark with PERS, Scott came to Juneau as Northern Vice President of the Public Safety Employees Association to lobby for House Bill 242. This is legislation that would provide Tier 2 state troopers full medical benefits at their 20-year mark in the state of Alaska retirement plan. Unfortunately, the legislation failed to pass. Because the legislation failed, he needed to work an additional 7 years as a Tier 2 Alaska State Trooper to qualify for full medical at retirement. Since we had three daughters, this was an important consideration. My husband had worked 23 years with the state when he was killed, 2 years shy of retirement and qualifying for full medical. My first question to the state troopers helping me after Scott was killed was, do I and the girls have medical benefits? I was initially told I was set for life by one lieutenant. However, that was not the case. I was later told that my family's benefits would expire at the end of the month on May 31st. Finding this out, I was shocked, disappointed, and angry. I had thought the medical coverage would have been similar to what we were getting prior to Scott's murder. I felt his last 3 years of service were all for nothing. Scott always took his responsibilities very seriously to protect the people of Alaska. I had believed upon his death, the state would also take the responsibility to now take care of his family. I later learned Trooper Tage Toll's wife, Nikki Toll, had exactly 1 day of health insurance for her and her three boys after Tage and Mel Nading were killed in a helicopter accident on March 30th, 2013. What is frustrating is that the person who shot my husband to death and his father who helped move my husband's dead body, while they are incarcerated, they have medical available to them at no cost. I am here today asking for your support of House Bill 66, legislation that will help take care of the families of those peace officers killed in the line of duty in the state of Alaska. This legislation will ensure that another wife or husband will be allowed to grieve if they ever have to experience what I have, instead of trying to ensure their family has medical coverage. Thank you for your time today and your consideration of this important legislation.
And thank you for joining us. Are there any questions? Thanks again. Nikki Toll, are you with us?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Thank you again for joining us today, and again, please accept the condolences of the committee on your loss, and please state your name and affiliation, and you have the floor.
For the record, my name is Nikki Toll. I am testifying in support of House Bill 66 on behalf of myself, my three sons, my late husband, Tage Toll, and for the families of the Alaska State Troopers. For those of you who don't know my story, my late husband was Alaska State Trooper Tage Toll. He was killed in the line of duty when Hilo 1 crashed outside of Talkeetna during a successful search and rescue mission on March 30, 2013. Tage is an Alaskan hero. As a family, we were well aware of the dangers that faced Tage when he went on duty. I had faith and confidence in his abilities to handle himself, and in the training and skills he had as a law enforcement officer. The reality, nothing prepared me for losing my best friend, the father of my three children, and the life I had dedicated 19 years. Tage had been an Alaska State Trooper for 10 years at the point of his death. Tage and I had chosen Alaska as our home. My boys and I continue to make that choice because it is truly a wonderful place. Tage served Alaska with loyalty, integrity, courage, compassion, leadership, and accountability. When Tage was killed, I had 1 day of insurance coverage before, under current policy, it expired at the end of the month. Tage's body had not even been positively identified yet, and my three boys and I were without insurance. It was only after piles of paperwork and corrections to an inaccurate death certificate 4 months later that I was able to have the coverage I have now through retirement and benefits, but at 100% of the cost to myself. The burden was heavy enough without the added stress. My own health has suffered as a result of that added stress. Additionally, the man who has been charged with the murder of Alaska State Troopers Sergeant Scott Johnson and Trooper Gabe Rich has cost-free medical coverage during his time of incarceration. In contrast, Brandy Johnson, Scott's widow, and I were expected to carry the cost of our household medical expenses while working through the great grief of rebuilding our lives. Our husbands dedicated their lives to the pursuit of justice, but this is an injustice. House Bill 66 is part of the solution for that injustice. House Bill 66 remedies an oversight in Alaska's acknowledgement of it and honoring of its heroes. It covers the cost of insurance for those families who have lost their lives in the line of duty. The Alaska State Troopers have taken a serious hit the past 2 years with the fatal losses of Paige, Gabe, and Scott, and State Pilot Mel Mading. Now, with budget cuts and the reduction of services, the men and women of your Alaska State Trooper community need the encouragement and knowledge that their families will be cared for if the worst happens to them in the line of duty. Today, I am asking for your support of House Bill 66. Thank you for your time and consideration of this important piece of legislation.
And thank you again for joining us today. Jim Cockrell, Alaska State Troopers Anchorage. Are you with us, Jim?
Yes, I am.
And we're all holding our breath to see if we get an echo out of Anchorage, but so far it sounds pretty good. Please say your name and affiliation for the record.
For the record, my name is James Cockrell, C-O-C-K-R-E-L-L, Director of the Alaska State Troopers.
Please continue.
Yes, sir. I just, first of all, I want to thank you for allow me to speak at this hearing, and also the sponsor and co-sponsor for sponsoring this important bill, certainly for our division. I also feel somewhat honored to be able to add our support for the current administration and also the prior administration of Governor Parnell. Governor Walker's administration gave me permission to speak out and support the bill as a member of the Alaska State Troopers and a state employee. Shortly after May 1st, I was up in Fairbanks right after the incident that happened in Tanana. And, you know, being an Alaska State Trooper for over 25 years, there was always that understanding that if I was killed in the line of duty, that my family would be taken care of. In fact, when you are a trooper in these type jobs, you discuss those issues with your spouse. I certainly did, in the event that something would happen to me. And it was surprising not only to myself but other members of the Alaska State Troopers that even going through previous death that our members weren't covered by health insurance after an incident like we had in Tanana. And I think if you look at, I know there's a lot of members of our department that's looking at what's going to happen to House Bill 66 and if it's going to pass where they can have assurances that if they are killed in the line of duty, their families will take care of. Health care is a very important benefit, as we all know. And with that said, I just think the state has an obligation to take care of our surviving family members, to provide health care premiums. And I will say for the record, the department has continued to pay the premiums for our four members' families till this bill gets taken care of. So with that said, I just want to say that I'm available for questions and that we fully support House Bill 66.
Any questions? Thanks again for joining us today. And Aaron Danielson, Fairbanks LIO.
Hello, my name is Aaron Danielson, A-R-O-N-D-A-N-I-E-L-S-O-N, and I'm the president of the Public Safety Employee Association.
Oh, thank you for joining us today. Please continue.
I'm here in support of House Bill 66. As PSCA, we represent not only Alaska State Troopers, but law enforcement all across the state, and so we have over 700 members. This bill that is in front of you today is important not only to our surviving families, but all law enforcement families. As police officers, we go out and work every day understanding some of the risks that we take, those that are in our control and those that are out of our control. But one thing you don't think about when you initially get hired is what are your health benefits for your family after you sacrificed in the line of duty. You just assume that the state, your city, your organization will take care of those, your family afterwards. Unfortunately, the policy that the state has had for many years does not do that. It has come as a shock and a disappointment for many of our members, and honestly something that bothers our families. They worry enough as it is about us, and now they believe that they're going to be, you know, left out to dry in some cases if the unthinkable can happen. We're thankful for the past and current administrations for helping the families of the tragedy events from the last years through the deaths and murders that have occurred, and that they have stepped up to do the right thing. But I think we support House Bill 66 to enshrine those feelings and those responsibilities in statute. We don't want any further families to go through what the families had you've heard from today. It's important to our current members, to our surviving family members, and everybody going through the future that this gets fixed, that this policy is improved upon and ensures the safety and well-being of our families. I urge you to please fix this and support House Bill 66.
Well, thank you for joining us today. With that, I'm going to go to the room. Is there anybody in the room who did not testify yesterday and has not signed up?
I asked to call in, but they said I couldn't.
Oh. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Molly Brink. Thank you for being here, and I hate testifying. I'm the wife of a Juneau police officer. And I don't know how I can say it any better than those three people before me. But this is a PERS and TERS bills. It's not specifically for police officers, but law enforcement is probably going to be the biggest beneficiary. It's the least we can do as a society for the people that put their lives on the line for the public every day. My husband's been working for the state for 27 years, the state or JPD. I'll be fine if something happens to him as far as medical insurance. But law enforcement it's a young person's job. They have small children. Some of them are going to be stuck with 4 or 5 kids, and they're going to have to figure out a way to get medical coverage. Or fight every year and hope that the state will throw it in the budget. So, thank you for letting me testify. I appreciate it, and I really hope that you guys support House Bill 66.
Well, thank you again for joining us today, and please accept my condolences on behalf of the committee for your loss. And, pardon me?
I don't have a loss. I'm just scared to death to testify.
Oh, that's...
Thank you.
Anybody else that didn't sign up that would like to testify that hasn't? Seeing none, we're going to hold public testimony open and set the bill aside. Thanks again for everybody that had to wait an extra day to testify. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease. And we're back on the record. Next up is House Bill 12. With us to present the bill are Representative Hughes and Representative Kimberly Swantek, who I believe is her first time before the committee, if I'm not mistaken. So who's doing the heavy lifting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start. And not only is it Kimberly's first time before this committee, but it's her first time ever presenting a bill, so we wanted to make sure that we didn't finish out this year without giving her that opportunity, so I appreciate that.
Well, before you get too far into it, we do have a CS in front of us, blank CS. I would entertain a motion to adopt the CS as the working document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move CS HB 12 version 8 as the working document.
And seeing no opposition, the CS is adopted as the working document. Please continue, Representative Hughes.
And just to get on the record as well, I am Shelley Hughes, Representative for District 11, Palmer, and with me is my staff, Kimberly Swantek. She will, after I do an introduction, she will walk you through the bill with a section analysis, and then if there are questions, my staff, Ginger Blaisdell, will come up for that. So thank you for hearing this bill, HB 12, mortgage lending. And I was thinking about it over the weekend and realizing that often there are four reasons why we hear a bill, particularly in this committee. And one is often to protect the public. A second reason is often we need updates to because of new phenomena and counter things as the decades progress, such as new technology or new business models. So an update. Number three, we do it sometimes. We want to create a more level playing field. And number four, there's something that we can do to help simplify the process, whether it's for a business or for the state of Alaska, so for simplification. Well, I realize this bill does all four of those things. It protects the public. It's an update because of a new business model. It creates a more level playing field, and it simplifies the process for the business as well as for the state of Alaska. So with that in mind, I'll just fill you in. It's a little bit confusing. There is a flow chart you might want to have out and refer to. That's the Division of Banking created. It was very helpful for me. And I will explain to you, under current statutes, a depository institution, or a bank, better known as a bank, a depository institution and each of its employees, not a contractor, but an employee who is a licensed mortgage loan originator, which we call an MLO. If they're an employee MLO, they are exempt from needing a mortgage lender broker license. And the reason they are is because the bank falls under federal regulations. However, if the licensed MLO is not a direct employee but is instead a contractor, currently our statutes require that that person not only have a license as an MLO but also has a license as a mortgage lender broker. And so they're double layered license. So they have to get the MLO license, they have to get the mortgage lender broker license. And what HB 12 does, it helps create a more level playing field in the mortgage lending industry by eliminating an unnecessary layer of licensure. So instead of requiring this contractor MLO to also be licensed as a lender broker, they will simply be licensed as an MLO, just like the employee MLO. However, what the bill also does is it now gives state supervision and regulatory authority over the bank, where it can require reports and audits. Currently, that is not the case. So a bank that is over contractor MLOs, the state can't really do anything with them. They're just under federal regulations. So now the bank will have to register with the state of Alaska. So in essence, what this means is the contractor MLOs, they will no longer be supervising themselves. Before, they were the broker and the MLO, so they were in essence supervising themselves. Instead, the bank will have responsibilities for some of that supervision. So again, we're creating a more level playing field. We're better protecting the public because the bank now has oversight by the state as well as the federal government. And it simplifies the process for the state of Alaska because before the state, if it were going to do any checking, it had to go to each of these contractors all over the state. Now they can just go one point of contact to the bank where they'll be able to get the information they need. I thought if we could just look at the flow chart too, if you want to pull that out, it looks like this. I don't know if does everyone have it? You can see over on the left hand is what we think of typical banks that have employees that are MLOs. And you see at the top, the red hexagon is the federal government, but there's not a blue hexagon. The state of Alaska does not supervise the banks in this regard. However, if you go to the middle, the way it is right now for banks that have contractor MLOs, they have quite a convoluted process here, and you can see the state has oversight. What the bill does is, to the column on the right, the state will have oversight now of the depository institution instead of directly within each independent contractor, as well as audit authority over the contractors too. Through the MLOs have to be licensed and registered But you can see there's actually an extra layer in that right column that still needs to be there. Because it is a bank, it has to be under federal regulation as well. So we are simplifying it. We can't do anything about that extra federal layer, but it definitely simplifies from the middle. And that, I just thought, was I really appreciate the Division of Banking for providing that, because it was very helpful to me, because it was quite confusing. One more thing the bill does, and then I'll hand it over to Ginger, is that the bill also exempts Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and any government agency from the state mortgage lender broker license requirement. The government agencies would be responsible to ensure that their MLOs meet the standards equivalent to the Federal SAFE Act requirements. And so with that, Mr. Chair, Kimberly could go through. And I would also ask, if it's all right with you, Chair, Mr. Chair, if we could hold the questions for the other staff, Ginger, and just allow Kimberly to go through the sectional analysis, if that's okay with you.
Probably the most efficient way to do it.
Thank you.
Any questions for the sponsor, though, before she leaves the table? Thanks again. You can join us back up here. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and we don't bite.
I'm Kimberly Swantek, staff to Representative Shelley Hughes. And I'd first like to thank the chair and Representative Hughes for giving me this opportunity today. I'll be going through the sectional analysis for version H, dated April 11, 2015. And I'll try to get through it without getting tongue-tied, so bear with me. Section 1, page 1, outlines the license requirement for mortgage loan originators and adds that individuals can be licensed as mortgage loan originators if he or she works under an exclusive contract for a registered depository institution, as stated in line 11, subsection B, or be sponsored by a registered depository institution, as added in line 14. Sponsored in this section means to conduct business under the supervision of a mortgage licensee or a broker or a registered depository institution. This section creates that supervisor-to-employee type of relationship that Representative Hughes mentioned, except with independent contractors. Section 2, page 2, line 5, adds a new section outlining the requirements for a registered depository institution to be eligible to sponsor a mortgage loan originator. By adding a registered depository institution, or an RDI, as you'll hear me say, throughout this chapter creates the same requirements for mortgage licensees, like I said, or they're also mentioned as, or mortgage licensees or brokers, as sometimes you'll hear. Section 3, page 3, line 8, exempts government agencies. By exempting the government agencies, the state of Alaska recognizes them under the SAFE Act, effective August 30th, 2011. And you'll also notice that this version of the bill has removed all language pertaining to bona fide nonprofits that was in version A. So you'll see in section 3, it just pertains to exempting the government agencies. Sections 4 through 7 on page 3 include registered depository institutions and the bonding requirements that are the same for mortgage licensees. So you'll see that most places where they mention mortgage licensees, we just added language for registered depository institutions. And I'll quickly go through those sections. Section 4, line 12, requires an RDI applicant to have a surety bond. Section 5, line 19, ensures that an RDI does not have to file more than one bond if they cover more than one location. So instead of having 15 separate, you know, contractors apply for a bond, this just ensures that only one is filed. Section 6, line 23, requires that the bond last for 3 years. Section 7, line 27, gives the department authority to determine if that bond is unsatisfactory. Section 8, page 3, line 31, through page 4, lines 1 through 13, amends annual reporting requirements by requiring registered depository institutions to follow the same reporting requirements as mortgage licensees and be subject to the same penalties if that report is not filed as required. Sections 9 through 13 on page 4 and 5 include registered depository institutions and the existing requirements for managing mortgage records. Again, where we have language for mortgage licensees, you'll also see that language was added for registered depository institutions. And again, I'll quickly go through those sections. Section 9, line 17, applies to business transactions that occur entirely or partially in the state of Alaska. Section 10, line 20, requires accounting records be kept in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. Section 11, line 25, requires the retention of all records pertaining to the loan, including those that are kept electronically, be kept for 3 years. Section 12, page 5, line 3, requires that the note and all associated documents also be kept for 3 years. Section 13, page 5, line 11, requires that a mortgage loan servicing agent who is conducting business on behalf of a licensee or an RDI maintain adequate records for 3 years. And a mortgage loan servicing agent could be an accountant, a legal counsel, or a collection agent, anyone who may be conducting business on behalf of an RDI or a licensee. Section 14, page 5, line 29, requires records maintained by an RDI outside of the state of Alaska be made available to the state of Alaska, or in the department specifically. Section 15, page 6, line 10, provides the department with investigation and examination authority to determine compliance by a registered depository institution. Section 16, page 6, line 22, adds a subsection L. A person and a person subject to this chapter include a registered depository institution. Section 17, page 6, line 25, through page 7, line 16, allows the department the authorization to censure, suspend, or bar a depository institution in the same manner as a mortgage licensee. Section 18, page 7, line 18, allows the department to hold administrative hearings and issue disciplinary orders on RDIs. Section 19, page 7, line 26, adds the definition of a registered depository institution. And sections 20, 21, and 22 allow the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to adopt regulations by January 1st, 2016, and provides for an effective date of January 1st, 2016.
Are you up next, Ginger, before we start asking questions?
Thank you, Chairman Olson. My name is Ginger Blaisdell. I'm staff to Representative Hughes, and I'm here just to help answer questions.
Who's got the first question for either one of them? Representative Colbert.
It sure seems like a lot of legislation to accomplish what this simple thing you want to do. Do you have to address every section in code? Is that what... Anywhere mortgage is used, we have to go in and add the language?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Culver, that is correct.
Has there already been, you know, because we had a lot of mortgage origination fraud back, I think, the last recession nationally. We've already had a lot of national regulations to deal with that, and we're simply regulating or... tweaking regulations here statewide on who can originate and how they do it?
Through the chair, yes, 2008 was kind of a mortgage lending debacle nationwide. And that's part of the reason that the SAFE Act was updated in 2008 and finalized in 2011. So that resolved some of the issues. This bill resolves more of a a business plan or a business model and makes it more of a level playing field with other mortgage lender brokers and MLOs.
Well, would it be fair to say this creates more of a level playing field besides non-traditional lenders, maybe insurance companies versus banks and other entities? Or is that what we're trying to create, a level playing field for other investment houses to offer mortgage loans similarly?
Through the chair, Representative Culver. The level playing field is really more of an administrative leveler. And so people that are conducting same types of business will have the same type of licensure requirement placed on them. If this bill did not pass, the bank that's in the state of Alaska now that has independent contractors can still conduct business. They can still issue mortgages. They can still do all of the things they're doing. We're just making the education and the licensing requirements the same as others doing the same kind of business.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're getting off light. No further questions this time? Seeing none, we will open up public testimony. Anybody in the room that hasn't signed up or has signed up? Nobody? Oh, come on up. Welcome, Christy. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Christy Babcock, and I am an independent contractor, State Farm agent in Kenai. I sincerely thank you for scheduling House Bill 12 and for introducing it. And I appreciate the opportunity to express my support for House Bill 12. I've been an agent and small business owner in Kenai for the past 15-plus years. I employ 8 individuals in my office. I market insurance and bank products exclusively on behalf of State Farm Insurance and State Farm Bank. As part of my business, I originate home loan applications exclusively for State Farm Bank. As an originator, that's basically somebody who originates the initial application. Banks and their employees, originators, are exempt from state licensing because they're federally regulated. But because I'm an independent contractor, I'm required to be licensed as and follow all of the state regulations for mortgage loan originators. The NLO license requires rigorous state and federal testing, background checks, fingerprinting, annual continuing education, and licensing renewal. I've gone through this process so that I have one more way of serving my customers and providing more lending options for Alaska homeowners, many of whom I have a long and trusted relationship with as clients. I don't contest this state NLO licensing requirement. HB 12 wouldn't change or reduce that requirement in any way. What HB 12 does address is an additional license I'm required to have because of an anomaly in the statute. Under Alaska law, an NLO must be sponsored and supervised by a mortgage broker. But because banks are exempt from having a mortgage broker license, I must also be licensed as a mortgage broker. Ironically, to sponsor and supervise myself as an NLO. That makes no sense because, one, I'm supervising myself, and two, I'm not brokering loans. It isn't required in any other situation, and it causes unnecessary expense and is burdensomely time-consuming. The extra cost is approximately $2,000 per year for the broker license, and dozens of hours are taken up in quarterly reporting, quarterly filing, annual reporting, annual licensing, and even more reporting every spring. HB 12 is a win-win solution because it removes the unnecessary costs and burdens on me as an MLO without reducing any protections associated with broker supervision. The fix in HB 12 allows the sponsoring bank, in my case State Farm Bank, to step in and register with the state of Alaska as my supervisor. By registering, the bank assumes all the liabilities, responsibilities, and oversight as they were my broker, as if they were my broker. This makes more sense because it's the bank that is the lender, while I'm just the originator. And it actually provides more oversight to have the bank be my supervisor rather than me supervising myself. Basically, right now, I currently wear two hats, and HB 12 doesn't eliminate a hat. It just simply moves that hat to where it logically should be worn by the bank. 26 other states have licensing requirements similar to what HB 12 does, and there is pending legislation in other states as well. In closing, I want to emphasize that this bill would not result in any less regulation for me than for other MLOs. We would all have the same requirements of the residential lending companies, plus the continuing federal oversight over the banks. This legislation was first introduced in the 2014 session. I sincerely hope that you will pass it out of your committee this afternoon so that it may move forward for further consideration. And again, thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
You got off light. Thanks, Christy.
Thank you.
Next up, Roger Bainbridge.
Good afternoon.
For joining us today, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Roger Bainbridge, Bloomington, Illinois. I represent State Farm Bank as in-house counsel. I will save the committee time and not even go off my notes because I think Christy did a fantastic job explaining not only what the issues are, what I think is a very simple issue, and the fact that the SAFE Act didn't contemplate an independent contractor working on behalf of a exempt depository institution. So given all of that information, really I guess I would just point out a few of the things that Christy said. 26 states have adopted legislation or otherwise provided State Farm Bank the opportunity to register an exempt company solely for the purpose of sponsoring its MLO licensed, state licensed agents in those states. And the other thing not to miss is, as a federally chartered savings bank, the Federal State Farm Bank is already regulated both by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. By bringing in the Division of Banking on top of that for loans originated by our MLO licensed agents, I think that really gives you the sense of the dual and layered supervision and examination that these loans that our MLO licensed agents would originate will receive. So with that, I would just thank you for your time, thank you for this hearing, and ask for a due pass recommendation. And I'm also available to answer any questions.
I guess I've got the first one.
Sure.
26 states, was that model legislation, you know, NAIC or NCOIL or...
Mr. Chair, no, it's not. It's actually legislation that State Farm Bank has been working with other states, other banking departments, and since about 2010, we've worked on these issues with other states. We continue to work with the remaining 10 or 15 states that we have similar licensing situations like the state of Alaska.
So is it the same in all 26 states, or have you tweaked it?
Mr. Chair, it is tweaked based on the concerns of the banking department in that state. Some states want it very specific to almost our particular business model. Other states would like it more broadly, that it doesn't limit it to just one insurance company. Perhaps any depository institution utilizing independent contractor agents could utilize that. So I would characterize the Alaska version of this as a more broad less specific version, and again, it really depends on what the banking department will support, because obviously we need their support in order to move legislation like this. And I would also mention the Alaska Division of Banking. We have worked closely with them for the past several years. As Christy mentioned, we have 16 or 17 licensed State Farm agents currently, and we have had several examinations, state exams, of those agents' offices. So again, I think we have a good working relationship with the Alaska Banking Department. They understand our business model. They understand how our agents function and the limited activities, the origination activities, as Christy described, that they provide, and then kind of how that transfers to the bank and the bank's employees who are federally registered, who would then process decision and close loans.
Thank you. Anybody else have any questions? Thanks again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
John Kerman, Anchorage, are you with us?
Hello?
How's this, John?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you've got our undivided attention.
My name is John Carman, C-A-R-M-A-N. I'm president of Homestate Mortgage and also chairman of the legislative committee for the Alaska Mortgage Bankers Association. I'd like to thank Chair Olson and Representative Hughes for allowing me to speak on this. I've actually spoken with Representative Hughes many times, and I'm actually grateful for her communication throughout this, and I think this has been going on since last year, and I can't say that I'm still totally in favor of this bill, and I'm not really in agreement with the characterization so far. I know the other speakers would characterize it as a level playing field. In my mind, it's a remodeled playing field to accommodate the State Farm Bank model, where they have non-employees that they are sponsoring as opposed to employees of the bank. It's true that when First National Bank has an employee of the bank and all the liabilities that an employee implies, that there is not separate registration requirements. But State Farm, in the State Farm Bank model, these are independent contractors working, I believe, primarily as insurance agents that are also doing what we're characterizing as originating a loan, but I believe in the reality is they're referring those loans to State Farm Bank for origination. The bank is, I can understand it, is a very limited model. It only does loans that are conventional loans that are fixed rate 30, fixed rate 15, and some adjustable rate mortgages. For instance, they do not do FHA, VA, Alaska Housing, Cook Inlet, RD, HUD 184, 203Ks, all the other loans that are out there. And I guess it does concern me that if the agents don't do those loans and don't have them available to them, that they're giving their clients the best advice in every situation. But I have to admit that currently they are operating under the model where they form a brokerage and then employ themselves as an employee and the only employee of that brokerage. And I've talked to Kevin Anselm, and I agree that it would make the Division of Banking's job easier to regulate these companies by changing this model. But although it would make their job easier, I just still have a hard time supporting the model fully. But I guess this is an improvement over our existing situation. So I'll leave it at that.
Any questions for Mr. Kerman? Seeing none, thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Michael Martin, Alaska Bankers Association, are you with us?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Olson and members of the committee. My name is Michael Martin. I'm the EVP and General Counsel of North Rim Bank, and my affiliation is with the Alaska Bankers Association. Definitely appreciate the opportunity to testify today. The Alaska Bankers Association published a letter on April 10th in opposition to House Bill 12. I had an opportunity this morning to read the most recent version and some supporting materials that were provided, and I very much appreciate the Division of Banking and Securities in the exhibits that they have provided. It was very helpful. I noticed that the original version has been modified to eliminate what was a proposed exemption for nonprofit entities from the licensing requirements for their mortgage loan originators. It was one of the matters that was originally objected to, or we were in opposition for the Alaska Bankers Association. That has subsequently been removed from the proposed bill, and I appreciate that change. I think that's a step in the right direction. The materials were valuable to me this morning when I had an opportunity to review them, because it, I think, better illustrated kind of what the what it will look like, what the regulatory environment will look like in the event that this bill passes. I have to admit that I haven't had a chance to fully digest that. The Alaska Bankers Association is going to convene on Friday, and we'll have an opportunity, both all of us, to review that material and to come together. You know, our concern with the original version of the bill was this exemption for the nonprofits, and we were concerned that, you know, this notion of level playing field is difficult to define, but we're concerned that some of these mortgage loan originators would be unlicensed and potentially unregulated. And as I said earlier, these materials definitely helped me to understand. I know it's being categorized as making everything simpler, and I would propose to you that there's nothing about this statute or even the proposed modifications to the statute that are simple, and does require some time to wade through all of that. But I very much appreciate Representative Hughes' time and that she has spent with the Bankers Association, and Director Anselm with the materials that were provided. And thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Any questions for Mr. Martin? Thanks again for joining us today. Kevin Anselm, Division of Banking and Securities.
Yes, Chair Olson, I am on the line and available for any questions.
What's your feeling on the bill? Do you support it or not?
We are neutral on the bill.
Let's see, that goes, we'd either support or oppose? No, that's how we used to get it. But any questions then for Ms. Anselm?
Yes, thank you, Kevin. First of all, I want to thank you very much for the work that you did to help us understand how it works now and how it would work under HB 12. I think one reason why there weren't a ton of questions is because of the graphic that you provided. But I do have a question about the fiscal note, because it mentions in the description something about the bona fide nonprofits. And was that just an oversight where that didn't get taken out? Can you address that, please?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, that's true. The original fiscal note was put together back in January, and since the new amendments had not been made yet, the fiscal note has not been changed, although the bottom line is that we don't believe there will be any fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you very much.
Any further questions? Thanks again.
Thank you.
Mike Wilkinson, Anchorage.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Are you in the new LIO by chance?
I am, and it's a wonderful building. My first time here.
I haven't had the opportunity to see it again, but I just noticed where you were calling in from. Thank you again. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Mike Wilkinson, W-I-L-K-I-N-S-O-N. I serve as Alaska's agency field leader for State Farm Insurance. And I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for holding this hearing. Briefly, I just wish to express my support for House Bill 12, as it allows shifting the responsibility and oversight required of a licensed mortgage broker over our independent contractor mortgage loan originators from the individual agents to State Farm Bank. In my opinion, I believe the public would be better served if State Farm Bank were allowed to legally assume all the assurances, oversight, and reporting requirements of a mortgage broker licensee. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you again. Any questions? Seeing none, anybody else in the room? Seeing none and nobody else online, we have two people that dropped off apparently. Is TW calling back on that? Or,
no, just got plugged into the
system. Okay, I'm just wondering why the RCA had an interest in it. But with that, I will close out public testimony. What are the wishes of the committee? I, for one, still have a couple of questions, and I think we scheduled this for Wednesday as well. A couple of people that dropped off, or at least one of them was another one of the bankers, and with that, I think we're going to be holding it over till Wednesday. And with that, we will take a brief at ease and set up for the next bill. We're back on the record. Nobody else peels. Next item on the calendar is House Bill 122. We had this one scheduled for a week ago, and unfortunately, we weren't able to hear it at the sponsor's request at that point in time. But with Representative Culver is Angela Steppel. It looks like Dave.
Dave Scott. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll settle for Dave. Who's going to be carrying the bill?
I'll just introduce it and then I'll turn it over to Dave.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Representative Jim Culver, District 9. House Bill 122 is intended as a red tape cutting instrument to save money and time of our state departments and of businesses. Currently, corporations must fill out biennial reports every 2 years, just lists updates their corporate officers, nothing much to the form, and submit with a, I believe it's a $100 fee. This bill would make that a 4-year cycle, create less paperwork for the department, and the other thing it does is that if a corporation is not renewed through this process, it will automatically lapse and be and what do we call that word?
Sunset,
there's another word for dissolve. The corporation would dissolve. So this is a mechanism to kind of save everybody some time and money. It really, just the same fees, you just double the fees if you did it versus 2 years versus 4 years. It kind of creates an issue on cash flow, and thus you'll see that in the fiscal note that you get a burst of cash more later and less earlier. It's the same amount of money. There is some funding attributed like we normally see to any bill that goes through this committee. We want to write regulations and that costs you money. So I think that could be whittled down somewhat, but there's a fiscal note for the regulatory requirement. With that, maybe turn it over to my aide, Dave Scott, if he could fill in the blanks there.
Welcome back, Dave. Please take the record.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, David Scott, staff to Representative Culver. The
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the bill amends and affects two titles, Title 10 and Title 32. Title 10 is Corporations and Associations, and Title 32 is the Uniform Partnership Act. The intent of the bill is to change the reporting requirements from 2 years to 4 years for cooperative corporations, nonprofit corporations, religious corporations, limited liability companies, limited liability partnerships, businesses, and professional corporations. It's important to note that there are no changes to the information or the substance of the required reporting. Therefore, you'll see that most changes are conforming and that most of the sections make the following changes, from biannual report to status report, or biennial corporation tax to corporation tax. So in effect, we are basically removing the word biennial from the reporting statutes. As an abbreviated sectional, sections 1 through 18 relate to the Alaska Corporations Code. Sections 19 through 25 relate to the Cooperative Corporations Act. Sections 26 through 36 relate to the Alaska Nonprofit Corporations Act. Sections 37 through and 38 relate to religious corporations. Sections 39 through 45 relate to Alaska's LLCs. Sections 46 through 49 relate to the Uniform Partnership Act. Section 50 is a transition provision. Section 51 relates to the reg authority. And Section 52 and 53 are effective dates. Some sections of note, Mr. Chairman, are Section 6 on page 4. Is where we make the report from every 2 years to every four. Section 12, which is on page 6, changes the amount of the filing fee. So it needs to be noted that while we are doubling the filing fee, we're also doubling the years. So there's going to be a status quo is going to be maintained. So instead of paying $100 every 2 years, you're going to pay, if the bill passes, you'll pay $200 every 4 years. You should also note that sections 18, 25, 36, and 49 are definitions. And section 50 is a fairly lengthy transition provision in the uncoded law to allow for the orderly conversion from a two-year to a four-year period. With that, Mr. Chairman, I could try to answer any other questions on the mechanics of the bill. We should also note that Sarah Chambers from DCCED is also who's probably going to save me.
Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Liddell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the presenter or for Ms. Chambers, is there something that the department might catch that would be a source of some concern during a four-year window that they previously would have caught in a two-year window?
How about for the sponsor? Sarah will be coming up after.
I'll save that same question then. If she can recall it for Ms. Chambers. Thank you.
I was just wondering if you changed it from to status report because nobody could figure out whether quadriannual was actually a word or something. Is that why you chose to make it status report rather than a quadriannual report?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that was fully within the purview of the drafter. We had nothing to do with that.
I appreciate the intent of this bill, but I am kind of concerned when I look at the fiscal note because it's going to cost us, $72,800 to get this up and running. And in a year where we're, the 2 years where we're tight, we would actually take a little bit of loss because that money wouldn't come in farther down the road to the tune of $3.1 million. Am I reading that correctly? And again, in next year, $2.6 million. And then we'd start seeing it come in. But I was confused, again, by 2020, because wouldn't we cycle it so you'd get some every year? I'm just confused by 20 and 21 being without the funding coming in again.
Well, thank you, Representative Hughes, through the chair. We'll probably have the department address that, but one thought I had as we've seen some of these bills come across the floor that we have a delayed effective date, so we don't necessarily take a fiscal hit early on. Maybe put the enabling legislation, we might look at amending this bill to change the effective date and try to get the law in place. and not have the imminent fiscal reallocation of those dollars.
So follow up. So the first year we'd go without, say you'd move it to 2018, 2019, but still we have this cycle where you're bringing in money 2 years in a row, and then 2 years in a row you're not. And I guess I'm having trouble wrapping my brain around the 2 years that you're not. Once you get out there, it seems like you should every year. You're just staggering who you're collecting from.
That, I guess that'd be through the chair more appropriate. I guess we'll ask the department to answer that on how the mechanics of the collections. Yeah, you're right, because there'll be new corporations that sign up or merge or whatnot, and they'll be on a different cycle. Eventually, it will probably stretch out some.
Any further questions? Seeing none, come on up, Sarah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the operations manager for the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
First question, Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair. My previous question, Ms. Chambers, was what is it that the department is looking for when they inspect these reports, and what could go missing if they don't inspect them every 2 years?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there are some pretty basic pieces of information that the department currently collects on a biennial basis. Primarily, what we need is to know who are the officers of a corporation, who is the registered agent, how do we get a hold of them. Those are really some of the very bare bones pieces of information that we need. There are quite a few agencies and private entities who also utilize that information. We tend to be a collection point, a repository for that, and then there are many entities that use that information for their various purposes.
Probably on the same point, is there any information that, other than that, that would be useful to you, or if you're waiting every 4 years for something you got every 2 years, that could there be situations where the financial status might be changing or evolving slowly? And I mean, I don't know. It's been so long since I filled one out.
Mr. Chairman, we did look at the impact of not having that data on a biennial basis. This would make Alaska the only state that doesn't collect it on an annual or biennial basis, and there's the possibility of not having accurate data if the corporation's only required to file every 4 years instead of two. Then they could change their officers, they could change their location, their registered agent, and it would be very difficult to provide accurate information either for research purposes, for private purposes, court purposes, state purposes. And so that is a concern that we have. The department is officially neutral on the bill, but that is a potential impact that we see.
Representative Ledoux.
So how would this work? And I'm not sure whether this is for Ms. Chambers or the sponsor of the bill. If within 4 years there's a change of the registered agent and you're trying to serve process on the registered agent, and the registered agent is no longer the registered agent, does anybody other than me see that as a problem?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's a concern that we weighed when we were learning about the bill as well.
Thank you.
Representative Hughes.
Yes, thanks, Sarah. Are you aware of any other states that have something similar where it's on a four-year cycle like this?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, our program coordinator over corporations and business licensing provided the analysis, and we worked through it. Her analysis showed that other states are working on an annual or biennial basis. I'm sorry, I can't independently verify that right now since she's out of town.
But a follow-up. You said annual or biennial? Just okay. Thank you.
Representative Colbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Chambers, do any states not require annual or biennial or any reports?
Through the chair, Representative Colbert, I'm not aware, but we'd be glad to find out.
Well, I got the answer to that question. There are. I can distribute for the committee, and maybe we have it with us, and Mr. Scott could present it, but we have done some research on that. There's different mechanisms around the country.
So that was a trick question.
Well, now I got a follow-up one.
So he's been sitting next to you too long.
What is the consequences for a corporation to not file a registration form, biennial form, for that corporation?
Through the chair, Representative Colbert, the biennial report, if we don't receive it timely, we have a courtesy notice that we send out to remind them that this report is required. If they don't file the report, then the corporation is involuntarily dissolved.
Okay.
Follow up?
Yeah, and I guess that's my point, that we have a piece of paper that restates corporate officers and registered agent, which can't be changed at any point with if there's a change in ownership. But then the corporation just goes away. And for $100, we're supposed to file that. But a corporation is supposed to be an entity. We still have to have a business license, occupational license. If you're an alcohol, you're going to have, you know, the business. So I don't know what the state's function is to make corporations go away. I don't know how that's in our interest. But that's one of the reasons to do the 4 years. So.
Representative Hughes.
Yeah, that spurs a question, Mr. Chair. Sarah, do we have cases where the form just, they just forgot and didn't get filed and we're dissolving? Are we dissolving corporations? How frequent is that? Is this a problem?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, we initiated just a few years ago a courtesy notice that's not required. It goes sort of above the bare bones efficiency measures, but we found that corporations do appreciate that reminder because they want to avoid being involuntarily dissolved if they want to remain in business. So we send a message that's been extremely helpful, and we've seen our numbers of involuntarily dissolved corporations drop dramatically. We would propose to do the same thing, to continue to do the same thing. It helps corporations maintain that statutory requirement, and as a side effect to the state, the net effect is any of the surplus for corporate filing fees goes into the general fund. And the last few years, that's been to the tune of anywhere between $5 and $6 million. So as we're investing in that, part of that $72,000 of the fiscal note are these informational mailings, but then that results in quite a deposit to the state for corporations maintaining that compliance.
Follow up.
So are those courtesy reminders going out before the due date, or if the report doesn't show up? So you are sending those out to everyone then, it sounds like.
We are, and again, I apologize, it's not my frontline program, but we are sending those out before we involuntarily dissolve the corporation. So we are hoping that everyone remembers it's the law that they file a biennial report. But before we sort of erase them off the books, we let them know that this is due and it's required, and that has resulted in an increase in compliance.
Yep.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So last year, as an example, how many were involuntarily dissolved corporations?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, I don't have that information at my fingertips, but if you'd like to go on to another question, I can sort through my papers and find it for you.
Yeah, and just a rough range would be nice. And then I did have a follow-up, but I think... Oh, I was wondering of those, Mr. Chair, thank you, of those that dissolved, are they reforming and starting over and forming a corporation again?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, each business model is different. Some dissolve because they simply aren't in business. Some come back in a different iteration. We get quite a few calls that say, we just had a circumstance in our business and we want to become the same corporation that we were. We just had a glitch in the system somewhere. So we do see a variety of models, but some do come back and just reform.
And then one more. And if they come back and reform, then is there an added cost to them more than the amount had they filed a report on time? Is it quite a bit more? And how does that compare to the biennial amount?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, they would have to file the initial filing paperwork, which again is just a matter of a couple hundred dollars, but it would be that initial filing, and then they would get on to the biennial report cycle.
Representative Ledoux.
Yes, I had asked a question a little bit ago about registered agents and whether there was a concern about that, but then I'm noticing on page 1, lines 12 through 14, that actually the corporation is dissolved if within 30 days it's failed to notify the commissioner of a change of registered agent. So that really wouldn't be a consideration with the 4 years versus 2 years, would it?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, that we would be able to involuntarily dissolve a corporation on that statute only if we knew about it. And so if a corporation changed its registered agent but didn't let us know it had changed, we wouldn't be aware and then couldn't investigate that and determine whether involuntary dissolution was the proper recourse.
Thank you. And just one follow-up question.
Sure.
I guess if it's just, I mean, you only put down in these biannual reports the registered agent and then the officers of the corporation. Is that correct? Is that all that goes in there?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, there are a few other lines of information that deal with shares and other business dealings. I apologize again, I'm not as intimately familiar with the form, but those are the primary, capturing that information that you just listed is the primary purpose.
Follow up? But it's relatively brief, and so I guess I'm wondering whether it might not make sense to simply have no requirement for annual, biannual, quadrannual, or whatever report, and just require a corporation when it's changed either officers, directors, registered agents, etc., just to file something with the state, and if it doesn't make any changes, then it doesn't need to file anything. It's just a thought.
Representative Colbert.
Ditto.
Well, I'll let you know where I'm coming at. How fast could you generate tomorrow morning a list of the 50 states and whoever else we have, Guam and Puerto Rico, on annual, biannual, whatever? Looks like Dave might have it. Can you give it to Conrad? My personal feeling is if we're on the cutting edge and most of them are annual or biannual, I think we might be jumping the gun a bit. But
could I address one of the issues that came up? What does the report contain? Corporate officers, secretary, treasurer, president, number of shares outstanding, and then the shareholder interest of the corporate officers. In other words, how many shares are issued, how many shares are outstanding, and what are the shares held by the corporate officers. That's reported, registered agent. That's pretty much it. But I think the point we're getting, or I think the committee gets, is that involuntary dissolution of a company because of failure to fill out this de minimis form is a rather harsh penalty. If maybe the committee doesn't want to go there as far as changing the cycle, we might ought to look at a little bit more forgiveness because it's expensive to re-up a corporation. You got to get, lawyers aren't cheap these days. and you're going to need some legal help.
Is that a rebuttal? Representative Joseph.
No, not on that point. It's a question for the sponsor.
Certainly.
Representative Culver, was that the impetus for this bill? Was the frustration over the dissolution threat? Or was it to save money for the corporation? Of course, it doesn't do that, does it?
I think you'll find, Mr. Representative Joseph, that I have a bit of a libertarian streak.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have to, why does government have to tell us to do something? Doesn't make sense. Could we get by with a different reporting period and achieve the same results? The threat of being dissolved over simply a piece of paper that doesn't, now they're online generally. You may receive the card in the mail that says you're late to file it, but you're supposed to keep track of when your biannual is due, and it's supposed to be filed by the end of January, I believe, in the reporting year it's due.
Okay.
Well, no matter whether we move the bill today or move it on Wednesday, which we have it scheduled for, it's going on to finance, which means that it's going to be a next year bill. At this point in time, finance is backed up, and what I'd like to do is give us a chance to look at this and do a little bit more work and bring it back up on Wednesday. And if everybody's comfortable with it, take a shot on moving it out. But if we move it out today, it's not going to have any difference on what happens in the next committee. Does that sound reasonable?
You want dinner before session, right?
Pardon me?
We need dinner before session.
Oh, it's going to be a long one tonight, by the way. But with that, we will adjourn, and we will hear this at the next meeting, or the meeting on Wednesday.